With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network. Today you have, as always, Mr. Mark Hamilton and Mr. Mark Daly. But we also have a bit of a special guest today. So, you know what, I don't want to tease and I don't want to give away too much, but a couple of days ago, Mr. Daly had the opportunity to sit down with the famous Australia FIA accredited journo, Mr. Stuart Bell, and they had a fantastic conversation. So I would ask you, plead with you, hang on, because that is absolutely worth listening to. But before we get to that, you know, we're 52 days away from what is scheduled to be the first race in Bahrain, although that could possibly change based on a lot of things that are happening right now. But we've still got a lot of other stuff to talk about. So Mr. Daly, you know what? You've done a great job kind of setting up for the podcast this week with that great interview. Where do you want to get started today?
Well, we're going to tease a little bit more. Not only do we have this really good segment with Stuart coming up in just a few moments here, but not only is it 50, did you say 50 days until the first Grand Prix now?
52 days.
52 days. But we are only just a little bit more than a week away from the first car launch. February 15th, mark it down now, the car launch, the official reveal for the McLaren. Shortly thereafter, we're going to be followed up with the car launch for AlphaTauri on February 19th, Alpha February 22nd, Mercedes all the way out on March 2nd, and everybody else, who knows? But
saw that Mercedes announcement this week as well, and the first thing I thought was March 2nd, and then I started doing the numbers, and I'm like, that's less than a month away. Like, yeah. That's going to be, that's 3-4 podcasts away.
That's right. That's going to come really quickly, and it is exciting. It's so distant. March 20, whatever it is, for the first Grand Prix of Lost Track now. But 52 days, it's actually going to come pretty quick. And, you know, once the car releases come, then for me, that's pretty much the unofficial start to the Formula One season. So it'll be nice. The week after next, we'll be talking about the first reveals, the first looks at the 2021 contenders, and just can't wait.
I know it's early, but of those cars that we're due to see over the course of the next, say, 30 days, which one are you most excited to see?
Oh, it's got to be the Aston Martin, because their social media people are wicked in the way that they've been teasing us over the past several weeks with these little hints and snippets here all over social media.
Right.
It's just, I want to see that one first. Well, it's not going to be first, but I can't wait to see it. I want to see them all, but that one in particular, because they've done such a good job at winding me up that I just can't wait to see that one. How about yourself?
Exactly the same. And you know what? Obviously, I'm excited to see the Mercedes car, but the Mercedes designs are incremental changes year over year over year. Now, last year was a little bit different because they went all in on that black livery, which was amazing. But I kind of expect that they'll probably transition back to that silver or that gradients into a darker gray. But the Aston Martin car, I have no idea. Like, it could be completely green, it could be neon, who knows? Now, we know that BWT is gone, so there won't be any pink components, but we just have no idea, and I think that's why that car is so exciting.
Well, we know the one thing that's pretty much a given is that the Red Bull is going to look like the Red Bull from last year and the year before and the year before. They've got their branding and everything, but they don't tend to shake it up too much. Well, I guess none of the other big teams do either. I mean, the big switch, of course, is, like you said, Mercedes, who went to the all-black for last year, but I guess maybe we'll see a little bit more maroon on the car this year. What with the Ineos partnership, because they're not just sponsors, they can 1/3 like owners in the team now, along with Mercedes parent company and with Total Wolf. So I wonder if we're going to see more of that sort of branding on the car this year, but we'll wait and see. But we should get right into the news now, because there's a lot of McLaren news out there, and I think this really goes together nicely with the conversation that I had with Stuart a day or so ago, and I think it's really interesting. And I hate to come across now as this Zach Brown fanboy, but I must admit that I'm still really impressed with the job that he's done with the McLaren. He's been quite vocal as well with the salary and the cost cap that's been out there. Well, the cost cap that's going to be implemented imminently, but he's still out there talking about having a driver's salary cap. And I think just in the day and the age that we are, that it just makes sense the way that they're trying to bring everything under control in this cost structure, that if everything else is being, you know, more monitored, more structured, the salaries just, it seems to be the one missing piece to the puzzle, Mark.
It's funny because I've thought so much about this, and I'm a big fan of North American sports. So when we talk about the NFL and Major League Baseball and the NHL, these are all sports that are really governed and regulated by salary caps, because yes, you need to be able to create parity. You need to make sure that you can have 30 capable markets that are able to compete at the highest level, and that the sports aren't always going to be dominated by the New York Yankees, the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Chicago Bulls, et cetera, et cetera. I like the concept, and I'm a big fan of the cost cap in Formula One as it applies to the cars themselves. So the development of the car, the cost of the mechanics, all of those kind of pieces. I'm really undecided about a cost cap for the drivers. And bear with me here, because I think in principle, it absolutely makes sense. But we're also talking about a sport that only has 10 teams and 20 driver slots. I'm not sure that if I'm McLaren, because my assumption here is that if I'm Zach Brown, presumably I'll have a better opportunity to court one of the top drivers, a Lewis Hamilton or a Sebastian Vettel or Max Verstappen. I still think that in the sport of Formula One, the top drivers are probably always going to lean into the teams that are fielding the most competitive cars. And my sense is that if you did create a salary cap for drivers, all you're going to potentially do is compress the value that these drivers can extract from the sport. And my fear then is, do they potentially look at other avenues to ply their trade? And I know this is really speculative. I know this is really out there, but I don't necessarily see what the benefit would be to the sport. Like, creating a budget cap in terms of the development of the car creates parity. I don't know that creating a driver cap is going to create any additional parity, but it would absolutely devalue the contributions of the drivers. And if I'm Lewis Hamilton and a team believes I'm worth $50 million, I absolutely think he deserves that $50 million. So I'm still of the mind that the two should be separate. And I still don't believe that the sport is big enough in terms of the number of teams and the number of driver slots that if I'm a Zach Brown, and I do agree, I think Zach Brown has done an exceptional job with McLaren, and I think it's unusual to see an American come over and succeed at the highest levels in Formula One. But I think if I'm a smaller team, you know what? I'm going to be pro driver cap, because maybe I can hold on to a driver that might otherwise be taken away by a Mercedes. You know what? I've developed this young driver. He's on the verge. We're on the verge. They can come in and offer him $20 million. I can only offer him $2 million. I kind of side with the drivers in this case. I don't like the idea of a salary cap for drivers. I don't think it's necessary, and I don't think it would produce any additional financial parity or stability within the sport. I know that's a long-winded answer, but it's just something I'm kind of passionate about.
Yeah, actually, you make a couple of good points I'd never actually considered before. But again, I think maybe what is interesting comparing, you know, Formula One to, say, the NFL. The NFL has, what, a roster of 50-something players?
I'm not sure exactly. Players are their only cost, right? Like, if you look at the NFL, if you look at the NBA, that's really your only outlay as an organization. Like, and again, there's some marketing costs and there's some insurance and hotel, et cetera, but your principal cost is your players. It's your player salaries. In Formula One, your principal cost is always going to be the development of the car.
Yes, of course. Yeah, that makes total sense. But it would be interesting, though, if this is something that they decide to go with. Would it be, for example, they have $10 million or euros or pounds or whatever per year to use? And does that mean you could, say, spend $9 million on one driver's salary and $1 million on another's driver's salary? I guess there's different ways you could split it up. So it'll be interesting to see how this...
Sorry, and maybe just the other thought, too, and I know we've got to move along here, but the other thought is, hey, you know what? If you go to the drivers and you pitch this idea of a salary cap, maybe you also introduce the idea of a salary floor, right? Yeah. Like, I think one of the things that Zach talked about is, hey, you know what? There's this discrepancy where, you know what? Some drivers are getting 20, 30, 40 million and other drivers are getting 1 to 8. But maybe the way you lobby the drivers is like, hey, you know what? We're going to have a salary floor and no driver is going to make less than 5. No, they're going to peak at 10 or 15, but no driver will make less than 5. So maybe that's a consideration as well.
Yeah, I think there's a case to be made for both of them. But moving along, just before we get to the first break here, we've got another quote. Zach, obviously a very good business person, very good at helping to run a team. Maybe not the quote machine that you'd like to see in pro sports, because he was talking this week about the nadir, the abyss years of McLaren. And he said that during those dark years, they'd become a little bit of Darth Vader when they should have been a little bit of more Luke Skywalker. So maybe not the comparison I would have gone with, but hey, I'm a Star Wars guy. I love it. You know, really into Mandalorian season two, watching that one over again, but that's a different story. But it was interesting. I mean, basically what he was saying is that they're a long way, or when he came into the team, that the team was pretty much declining in all areas. You know, they'd lost a lot of the big sponsors like they had back in the day, like Vodafone, Johnny Walker, ExxonMobil. And he said the car was basically devoid and blank of all sponsorship. He said that most people were walking around the factory with their, you know, looking at the floor. It was a heads down scenario. And he said it wasn't so much it was due to any one person or any one policy. He wasn't really playing a blame game, but he said that the one thing he noticed is what he called a revolving door of leadership, starting at the top of the organization. Of course, we saw Ron Dennis come and go, and we had Martin Whitmarsh in between there. And it's there. I mean, the history is well documented, but he really talks about what we've talked about before. And he talks about building a healthy organization, getting good people, getting them in the right positions, and then just letting them do their jobs. I mean, talking about guys, obviously, like Andreas Seidel, guys like James Key, and all these key appointments that they've made since he's been on board as CEO. And I think it was an interesting little insight. I don't think there's anything really shocking there, other than perhaps maybe not the quote machine that would really be clickbait worthy on this show. But whatever, I'll go with it.
And honestly, the only thing I'm going to add to this is I think one of the things I've heard, and I've talked to a lot of people in the F1 circus about where McLaren was 5, 7, 8, 10 years ago and where it is now and what Zach's contributed. Everything I've heard is that Zach is a big culture guy. You know what? He took an organization and you summed it up perfectly. Like, you know what? 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, you know, you had the mechanics and you had the designers and you had the engineers walking down, head on the floor. It was a depressed, even when they weren't where they became with that kind of Honda power unit, like there was a depressed attitude to the workforce. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that was Ron Dennis. So I think one of the best things that possibly happened was kind of that divorce and the departure of Ron Dennis, which allowed Zach to come in and completely inject a new culture and new life and energy into that factory. And you know what? I think the other probably positive thing that happened was also the divorce of Fernando Alonso, because I think he was creating a lot of distraction and a lot of friction. But I think Zach is a big culture guy. And I think where that team is now on the factory floor versus where it was 5 or 10 years ago, night and day. And I give him all the credit for that. And I'm very, very happy to see this team moving forward with their relationship with Mercedes. And this is one of those teams that I can't wait to see on the grid next year.
Yeah, absolutely. And just one final thing here before we go to the break, Mark, is I think you nailed it on the head there. I mean, I think the thing that needed to be done at the time was actually divorce themselves from Ron Dennis. I think it got to the point where the contributions that Ron made to Formula One and made to McLaren were obviously massive, but it got to the point where it needed somebody else to take the team and the organization forward. And there was a kind of a couple start and goes or start and stop instances, but they certainly seem to have the right people in place now. Anyways, we're going to take a short break here. On deck, we have F1 journalist Stuart Bell. We're going to talk a lot about, McLaren. We're going to talk about the Australian Grand Prix. He's based in Melbourne. Danny Ricciardo and all things related to Formula One in Australia. So I hope you guys will stick around for that. So don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors,
you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to the show, and as promised, I'm joined now by Stuart Bell. Stuart is an FIA-accredited Formula One journalist based in Melbourne, Australia. He's also a producer at The Inside Line. He's written for such outlets such as news.com.au, Seven Sport, and Motorsport Magazine. You can find him online at theinsideline.com and on Twitter at StuartBellF1. Stuart, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks very much. I'm great. It's summer here in Melbourne, and looking forward to the start of the season in Bahrain.
Yeah, well, it's completely the opposite as it is here. We've had some hiccups. It's been nasty weather today, but we shall persevere knowing that better days are ahead. And this is just Vancouver weather doing what it does best. It's blustery, it's wet, and it is what it is. But we're not here to complain about the weather. Well, maybe I am, but we'll keep that from everyone else. But Stuart, as we talk now at the beginning of February 2021, how are things in Australia, specifically in Melbourne, where you're living? Because the one of the big pieces of news in Formula One over the past month or so was the, well, I don't want to say the cancellation, but the rescheduling of the Australian Grand Prix later in 2021 until November. How's the situation there currently with the pandemic?
It's relatively good. I mean, we have 21 active cases as of today. In Victoria, in which is the state in which Melbourne is in, we've got zero cases in terms of community transmission, and it's generally pretty good. I mean, our restrictions. We were in a long, more than 110-day lockdown through our winter, so our freedoms have been sort of handed back to us in many ways. Still, social distancing and wearing masks. But the outlook is good, and we're hoping to keep that going. So obviously, we're very protected with those numbers, and that's what has led to the postponement of the Grand Prix to November 21. The writing was really on the wall for Formula One when the preceding tournaments, the Boxing Day Cricket Test and the Australian Open Tennis, both those sports in terms of the athletes and the all the people surrounding them were forced into 14-day hotel quarantine, which Formula One just couldn't do, given it's 2,000 people just for Formula One. So that made it very difficult, and that made the decision really an inevitable one. And so that's what's forced that. And hopefully, looking forward to November, it can happen normally.
Well, there are some initial good signs coming out from different parts of the world regarding some of these vaccination programs. And hopefully this is what you might say, maybe not the beginning of the end, but maybe the end of the beginning, that that there are some brighter days ahead. But obviously, it takes a long time to get the track set up, the grandstands, all the facilities. But in part of the reason in rescheduling till later in the year, do you believe that should things continue as they are, and that's a big if, and of course the situation can change, unfortunately, quite rapidly with COVID. But do you believe that the ultimate goal is to try and get spectators into the stands once the Grand Prix is ultimately run?
I do. The Australian government wants to have the entire Australian population vaccinated by October, late October. So that bodes well in terms of the event here. The event in terms of its original March date was always going to be just an Australians only spectator event. And they were hoping for around 50,000 people as a daily target, which obviously is very ambitious, but it was something they were pushing forward with. And I think in November, it will be the same thing in terms of hoping to have spectators there. What those numbers will be, who knows? but very much people are starting to go back to events here. We're starting to see live music happening, albeit with social distancing. So the hope will be to have a far more COVID normal Australian Grand Prix in November with the entire Australian population vaccinated.
You know, I don't think any of us will ever forget March 2020 when things globally started shutting down. I remember it quite vividly when it really started to get real, when there was first a test positive in the NBA and all the professional sports leagues started shutting down and countries and cities are locking down globally and locally. It was a very, very strange and a worrying time to live through. But you were right there at the Australian Grand Prix almost a year ago. What was it like? What was your experience in that that moment of change, of chaos? Use any word you want to describe it. It must have been a very, very unusual experience.
It was. It was very strange. It was very different to previous years because the Australian Grand Prix works like clockwork. Formula One works to a very sort of minute-by-minute schedule, and everyone knows what they have to do, and that's what it's been for many, many years. And it was almost like an hour-by-hour development. We were at Melbourne Park watching Lance Stroll having a hit with Leighton Hewitt pre-event. And even then, the COVID-19 had been upgraded to pandemic. And so everyone was wondering, what does that mean for us? How is this going to affect the event? Earlier, in the week, the Australian Grand Prix Corporation was sure that it wasn't going to affect us, that maybe a week or so in advance that it wouldn't have been able to go ahead if it was 2 weeks later than it was. But events unfolded to force the decision. But on the Thursday in the paddock, everyone was really just unsure of themselves. It was like everyone seeing a ghost. Formula One people are very focused people. Everyone has their own job, know what they have to do, and they get on with doing it. There is a little bit of chat in the paddock, obviously, but everyone is generally very busy and has a job to do. And to see people unsure of themselves and what they were doing, it was a very strange place to be, because as I said to you, everyone's normally very motivated and sure of what they're doing. So get underway, and it was mentioned in the press conference. The drivers were a little bit worried, and then once we saw that team members had started to be tested and there were potential positive results, it started to go downhill. And once McLaren's test result came back positive, a team member mechanic at McLaren came back positive at 10 p.m. on the Thursday night, that really forced everything to the house of cards to tumble.
You know, it's quite interesting over the weeks and months since the cancellation of the race that year. There's been different things that have come out, just sort of percolated up through the news. Was there ever, do you think, a possibility we might have seen a race run with, teams voluntarily withdrawing, much like we saw at Indianapolis, when was it, in 2004, 2005, when, what was it, the Goodyear tires, the teams running the Goodyear tires withdrew and left only the Bridgestone runners? Or was it going to be all or nothing, in your opinion?
It was going to be all or nothing. I mean, the local Victorian health authorities, the state in which Melbourne is in, had said that it could go on behind closed doors. But I think the Formula One community there was obviously debate. Mercedes was originally for the event going forward and for the race going forward. But the team spoke within themselves and came to a decision that they didn't want to go ahead with one team missing. So I think and it turned out to be the right decision, because as all this was going on, the worry of COVID-19 was ramping up. So to have a race going on right at that moment when it was exploding worldwide would have seemed wildly irresponsible. So I think Formula One made the right decision, and subsequent to that, made the right decision in making a raft of postponements in hand-to-hand with the countries in which the races were held, and then getting a 17-round championship up and running is incredible in terms of the turnaround and ensuring that Formula One continues, because the money, teams, churn through a lot of money and need that sort of income to keep going. So for the good of the sport, both teams, the FIA and Formula One, worked hand in hand to ensure their sustainability long term.
You know, Stuart, I'll be completely honest with you here. I must admit, rather selfishly, I was very disappointed that the start of the season was delayed, and what with the rescheduling of the Australian Grand Prix, and now we wait till the end of March, which is still some 50-odd days from now. It'll come quickly, of course. But it sets up a very interesting scenario. We're very much used to the fact that Melbourne is run at the beginning of the season, and it's very much, okay, one down, 22 to go. This is my first points of the season in the bag. And it's just the beginning of a very, very long haul of what is obviously a very long season, which runs basically half the year, if not more. But now moving to the end of the year puts it in a very interesting position that this could be one of these races that could potentially help decide the championship, come at a very crucial point of the year, which I think will be unique and I think will add a different spectacle to the race.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the stat is that Lewis Hamilton has won the title at the third last race in three out of the last 4 years. So the potential is there if that stat continues for a very exciting Australian Grand Prix to happen. You know, the Australian Grand Prix, in terms of Melbourne's sporting horizon, is the jewel in the crown. But we do have a lot of other sporting events, and March is very busy in terms of our calendar. We have the Comedy Festival, which is a big thing. We have the start of our football league as well. So it doesn't get lost, but I think it certainly, I think the November day will bring some impetus to it, some momentum, local momentum. And if the title is on the line, then that will just really connect with locals here, because Melburnians are huge sports nuts. And if there's a title on the line, there's something really to get behind. And, you know, in terms of November sporting events, we've got the Melbourne Cup, which is a big horse race here. But other than that, I mean, it really will feel a really nice void there in November.
How will it also work in terms of the weather? You're basically flipping from one half of the year to the other half of the year. What it'll be like for for those of us that are not particularly familiar with the climate and the weather in Melbourne in November? How could that potentially factor into the race itself? Is there the temperatures? Obviously, that's your summer. So is the temperatures going to be vastly different from the traditional spot in March, or more or less the same?
No, I don't think so. I think it'll be quite similar in terms of sunny days, potential hot day in there, but maybe some rain. But I think November is pretty stable and similar to March, in that it's a changing season. It's moving from spring into summer, and whereas March is autumn. Moving from summer into autumn. So I think similar sort of changeable conditions, potential for nice warm days and beautiful sunlight. So I think it really does make sense. It's like an interchanging of event and a great date change for us in terms of keeping it so it's not too hot or not too cold or not too much rain.
Well, considering what it's outside, my house today, I must admit that sounds absolutely lovely. So let's switch gears here, Stuart. Of course, we're in this sort of weird in-between time between seasons, but there are so many great stories coming out of 2020 and so many interesting threads to pull on going into 2021. I mean, you could sit here literally for hours and pull on each of them. But what are some of the interesting stories that you're going to be really focusing on going into the new year?
Look, I mean, I think it's 2021 is an interim year before the 2022 new regulations come in. So, but I think there's plenty of exciting story threads, as you said, with the return of Fernando Alonso after 2 years, which is going to be exciting, especially with the change to Alpine from Renault. Looking at Ferrari, the Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz, they're very young lineup, very hungry to move Ferrari back up the grid after their worst season since 1980. So there'll be a lot of hunger for them to move up the grid and pressure, especially from Italy to succeed. Obviously at Red Bull, you've got Sergio Perez joining Max Verstappen. I think it's a fantastic time for Sergio to be joining Max after 10 years in Formula One. And he's a different driver to that which joined McLaren in 2013. That was his first top team experience. And I think, the intervening years, coming off that win in Sakhir last year and all the experience that he's going to bring to Red Bull, obviously that's a difficult car to drive. We've seen Alex Albon and also Pierre Gasly struggling in that Red Bull car. And if Perez can get in there and they give him the right support, he's the sort of driver who needs a little bit of an arm around the shoulder, I think. But if he can get in, get the support network right and just, you know, deliver, then it could be an inspiring season for him. Obviously, Daniel Ricciardo at McLaren joining Lando Norris, moving from Renault. I think it's a really exciting time for Dan with all the ingredients there for him at Mercedes-powered McLaren. It could be, more podiums on the horizon for him as well.
Yeah, I think Ricciardo was an especially interesting driver to look at, considering he went from, obviously a top three team with the Red Bull, but certainly in 2018 was just that little bit further behind Ferrari when it came to regularly challenging Mercedes. But you have that sort of interesting interlude at Renault the past couple of years. Obviously, last year was marked by a couple of podiums later in the season, the Nürburgring and Imola. But that had to have been for Daniel a very tantalizing vacancy after Carlos Sainz was announced to being replacing Sebastian Vettel at Ferrari. And I've been very impressed with the work that Zak Brown has done at McLaren over the past several years, bringing in very, very good people to fill key roles at the team. And, I don't think it's any accident or, anything of the sort that they've slowly progressed up and gradually improved over the past couple of years. And I think they have a very good driver pairing now in Lando Norris and Daniel Ricciardo. And the question is how much further up can they go? Because I still feel that Ferrari will be an interesting team to watch, but I still think there's going to be a bit of a vacuum created by their drop off compared to where they were a year and a half ago. And I think that for a team certainly like McLaren and a driver like Daniel Ricciardo, I think must be really eyeing the new season somewhat eagerly.
Absolutely, I think Dan was. You know, when he left Red Bull because he was frustrated because they promised him title bids that never came. And in the intervening years, he moved to Renault. Obviously, the sport was blindsided when he moved to Renault because for all intents and purposes, he seemed like he was going to stay at Red Bull. They were a top team, and to switch to Renault, which was on an upward trajectory at that point, having gone from ninth to sixth to fourth in 3 years was an impressive move up the grid. But I think he learnt a lot at Renault. His first year at Renault was difficult. Gave him some sort of resolve to push forward with, and to get those two podiums last year in the Nürburgring at Imola were very impressive and allowed him to bookend his career there. I think I spoke to him in Brazil in 2019, and it did seem like he was going to stay there. Like it seemed like he was really impressed with how Cyril was able to, galvanize the team and keep them together. But obviously the potential at McLaren is they've got, an amazing list of ingredients there in terms of the Mercedes power unit. They've got Zak Brown obviously leading with Andreas Seidel, who Dan is a huge fan of in terms of the team principal, the architect of their future success. They've got James Key, who is the preeminent designer. They've got Andrea Stella in terms of, overseeing all their race strategy. And I just think they've got all their ducks in a row, if you will, whereas Renault is still sort of wondering about their top management with Marcin Budkowski and Davide Brivio obviously going to be at the top, but how that works and how the rebrand with Alpine is going to happen and Fernando Alonso's return. And I think there'll be a little bit of, it just makes it a lot more unsure in comparison to McLaren, which finished the season third last year and has the momentum behind it to do even better things this year going into the new era.
When I go back and think about that surprise announcement he made a couple of years ago in the summer of 2018 to say that he was leaving Red Bull and going to Renault, I mean, it obviously caught a lot of us, most of us, by surprise, because as you mentioned, it sounded like that deal to stay with Red Bull was all but finalized after the Hungarian Grand Prix. But I can't help wondering, and I've never heard anything to the contrary, whether it was said explicitly or not, whether that Dan just realized that the writing was on the wall and that Max was going to be the focus of that team going forward, and maybe that there was opportunities elsewhere. But I can't help but wondering, even though the Alonso announcement came after Daniel made it known he's going to McLaren, was whether or not would that have worked, that the $64,000 question, a partnership of Daniel Ricciardo and Alonso at Renault? Because Fernando casts an awfully big shadow, in my opinion.
Yes, he does. But I think, look, I think Dan is not afraid of a fight. I think, yes, you know, Max Verstappen is one of the most exciting talents to join Formula One in many years. He's the driver of his generation. But I think Dan is focused, is bursting to fight for a title. And that really is the crux of the matter. If you look at, and I put this to him, I said, you know, look at what Max Verstappen has done since you've left Red Bull. He's had five wins, you know, I think three and two in 2 years. And so that's not fighting for the title. I think the Honda coming on board, he was not sure of how that potentially was going to go. And obviously still Red Bull are trying to chase themselves in locking down that engine freeze for next year to be able to manage the Honda program themselves. So I think whether he would stayed at Renault and fought Fernando, he's I've spoken to him about that. He has no issue with Fernando, and I think they would have got along. Obviously, Fernando, we know, I've spoken to plenty of drivers in the past about him. He wants everything focused on him. He wants every part, every opportunity moves towards him. He is a team leader, but as is Dan, I think it would have been a difficult and tough battle. But I think when he saw McLaren, he saw potential. And when the chance came, obviously they'd been chasing him through when he was at Renault. So, you know, I certainly think that, you know, they've been talking for a long while and the chance came and he jumped at it.
It'll be certainly very interesting to watch. And if we sit down here at the end of 2021, after the season is done, and of course, this is maybe a little bit hard to speculate on, but what would you think would constitute like a successful season, a first season at McLaren for Daniel Ricciardo?
I think if he can get into the team, if he can galvanize the workforce and bring everyone together and start moving in the right direction, I think results, obviously they'll be looking at podiums, and if he can get a podium with McLaren in his first year and see how that team is moving into the new era, I think really it is about making sure that they're prepared for 2022. The new era regulations are a huge shift. And so if he can get on board and get into those plans and see what they're doing and make sure that everyone's moving in the right direction and galvanize the team and get everyone behind him, then, you know, it's got to be a working year. And whether he finished fifth in the championship last year, if he can do that or maybe go fourth, great. But I think really it's just about, this year is about getting into McLaren, working out what needs to be done and then preparing for next year.
You know, Daniel certainly is one of the great personalities in Formula One at the moment and certainly has a wonderful sense of humor. And although I've never met an Australian that's invited me to partake in a shoey, I don't know if that means I've been meeting the right Australians or the wrong ones. You know, I think it's probably the right ones. Certainly his own, you know, sense of humor, his enjoyment certainly adds something to the sport. And it was great to see him get back onto the podium a couple of times last year. I was starting to get a little bit worried because I admit I'm a fan of him. I enjoy his the way that he races. I enjoy the way that he presents himself in the media and the way that he comes across generally. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he can do this year. So before we wrap it up, Stuart, I would be remiss if I didn't put you on the spot here because I've mentioned Daniel Ricciardo, but Australia has produced some phenomenal Formula One drivers over the year. Daniel Ricciardo, Mark Webber, Alan Jones, Sir Jack Brabham. If we were to look into the crystal ball, who should we be keeping our eyes on in the future that might have that potential to make it to the big stage?
Well, I think the only option, certainly at this stage in terms of immediate talent, is Oscar Piastri, 19-year-old from Melbourne. He he really is the star on the rise at Renault. He won the Formula 3 championship last year. Before that, and that was in his first season. Before that, he won the Formula Renault Euro Cup in 2019, and in 2017, he was second in British F4. So he's got the momentum behind him. He's joining Prema Racing, which Mick Schumacher raced for and won the championship with last year. He's part of the Renault Driver Academy. He tested the RS18, the Formula One car in Bahrain late last year. He is the star on the rise. He's a very serious guy and very committed. And I'm sure the F3 and the F2 car are very vastly different machines in terms of the driving style they require. So if he can get in and start winning and potentially whether he wins in his first season or takes 2 years or learns it, and then wins it in 2022 to join F1 in 2023. We'll see. But he's certainly a strong talent. He's competitive. And, he's certainly the chance, Australia's next big chance.
Well, that's great. We'll certainly keep an eye on him. And, Stuart, before I let you go, and again, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Where can people find you online and check out your work?
You can just go to stuartbell.com.au or to unbeaten.com for all the inside line updates.
Well, that's great, Stuart. Thank you so much. Take care. Stay safe. I know you've got a flight to catch. And once again, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And I hope you guys enjoyed that interview, that conversation I had with Stuart Bell a couple of days ago. You know, it really was interesting in many things, but I just couldn't help but asking him right off of the top just what the situation was with COVID where he lives in Melbourne. And obviously, there's been a bit of a hiccup this week. What with the preparations for the Australian Open? There was, I believe, a security guard in the hotel where all the players and all the support staff and everybody's been staying in quarantining. So that's kind of thrown a little bit of a wrench into the works there. So we'll see how that plays out. But it was just amazing to hear. Of course, they did a really harsh lockdown there. You know, they're down to just basically double digits in active cases. And they've had a long period of like no new cases at all. And it kind of made me realize that we still got a long way to go where we live, but hey, whatever, you know, it is what it is. And at least, you know, we're here talking about Formula One and that's the distraction. But I thought that he made some interesting points. And one of them I thought that was, you know, I think that I'm really looking forward to is the rescheduling of the Australian Grand Prix. I mean, the one thing that Stuart said is they're hoping to have basically the entire population of the country vaccinated, or at least those people that are going to do it by October of this year. They're setting the Grand Prix up now for November. It's going to be right in that sweet spot that potentially we could see a championship decided, you know, if recent history is anything to go by. And the thing is, I think that Australia has been a great host of Formula One over the years, over the decades. And I don't want to say being the season opener, it lessens the event anymore because it doesn't. I mean, it is the kickoff to the season, but it is just the first stop on a very long season. To see it switch now to another time of the year, I think that I'm hoping that it'll you know, turn out to be an exciting finish, and it would be kind of cool to see a championship decided there for once.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add other than the fact that I think oftentimes it's a little bit anticlimactic when we conclude a season or a championship in Abu Dhabi. And with all due respect to Abu Dhabi, you know what? It's a very, very static kind of crowd. It's not super emotional. There's only 60,000 people there, but I can only imagine what the atmosphere would be like in Melbourne if the title was decided at that track. Like, I can't wrap my head around it. And the fact that we could potentially be in a position where you have the 70, 80, 100,000 people there on race day this year, fingers crossed, knock on wood, and a potential title decider, that would be amazing. And I also hope that the season plays out in such a manner that the title comes down to one of these final races. Like, I don't want to see another season where the title is decided with 3 or 4 or 5 races left. Like, I hope we're in a position where that could be the potential outcome, right? I think that would be amazing. I really don't want to see a title decided in Saudi Arabia. I don't think they deserve that experience, given the fact that this is their first year on the calendar. I don't want to see it happen in Abu Dhabi, but I would love to see a potential title decided in Australia, especially given the fact that they didn't secure a race last year because of the entire COVID situation, and this year has been bumped. But I also thought it was really interesting, especially that conversation that you had about the status of COVID in that country, and things can change quickly. But yeah, obviously, yeah, that country's done a great job. Their lockdowns were effective. They guarded their borders. They take things very, very seriously. And you know what? I believe that you and I were probably amongst the first media outlets that really began discussing the fact that, hey, the Canadian Grand Prix is probably probably not going to happen. And just so all of our international listeners can know, Montreal is in the province of Quebec. Quebec has been completely locked down since the middle end of December. They're slowly going to start reopening starting Monday. So Monday, they're going to start allowing some non-essential retail with limited capacity, limited hours. They're going to start letting some restaurants open with family-only bubbles. But you know what? At this point, we're what? March, April, May, June. We're 4 months away from when that race would happen and 2.5 months away from when they would need to start track preparations. Yeah. I don't think Canada's going to happen. And you and I have been saying it for a month, but I think that also speaks to the fact that F1 probably expected this and they probably built a lot of flexibility in the calendar for that reason.
Yeah, I think so. And they've hinted at as much over the past several weeks since they came out with a provisional schedule. And it was interesting too, when Stuart and I were talking off air, that usually the preparations for that middle of March date usually start the last week of January when they start putting up the grandstands, and usually everything's all taken down and everything's back to normal at the end of April, I believe he said. So I mean, he said there's a good also 4 weeks when that section of Albert Park, that main thoroughfare that actually goes into the central business district in Melbourne, is actually shut. It's completely closed off for about 4 weeks. So it is a major, major that thing that they do there. And it's a big event. It's obviously well-loved by the locals there. I mean, Melbourne has a reputation for a big event, big sporting event city. So it's great to see that it's going to stay there. But, you know, obviously we had to talk a lot about Daniel Ricciardo. I mean, Stuart has spoken with him quite a bit, and it was really good. I mean, last week we saw our first looks of Sebastian Vettel getting fitted up for a seat at Aston Martin. This week we saw our first looks of Danny Ricciardo getting fitted for a seat at McLaren. And so, again, it's one of these other indicators that we're getting very, very close to the start of the season. But just kind of leading off to where we were just talking before our chat with Stuart is that going back to our favorite CEO in Formula One, Zach Brown, he said he's expecting Sirius and not a goofy odd couple when it comes to Danny Ricciardo and Lando Norris. So I don't know. I think they're both pros, but I certainly hope that they don't like try and lock them down too much. I still hope that they have a little bit of fun, but obviously from a team point of view, they're not going to want them to get too silly or goofy, as Zach says.
Can you believe, and I thought the conversation with Stuart about Daniel Ricciardo was really good. And obviously, for those of you that don't know, and I think all of our listeners do know, Daniel Ricciardo is an Australian driver. He's one of the most charismatic, entertaining guys on the entire grid. Super, super likable. But I was looking at this earlier today because I'm like, man, when did he start his F1 career? This is going to be his 12th season in F1. And it's remarkable because I always think about him as kind of one of these younger drivers. But yeah, he's now in his early 30s. He's a veteran driver. He's kind of probably on the back nine of his career, but I'm incredibly excited to see. And you know, it's remarkable too, because I often have trouble compartmentalizing when certain things happen. And when I was looking at his career, you know, it was really 2014, that first year of the V6 turbo hybrids, that he kind of broke through when he had those three race victories. But again, I'm excited for him. Obviously, the first year with Renault was a disappointment. I don't know if he necessarily had big expectations. I think the fact that he was able to capitalize on some podiums last year was fantastic, and it built some momentum going into this year. I think the one consideration I have, and I don't want to get too far off base, is Renault and McLaren both benefited greatly last year by the absence of Ferrari on the podium week after week after week after week. And I wouldn't be surprised if McLaren finished lower in the constructors than they did this year. I think this year was an epic finish. And I think a fourth or a fifth place finish in a competitive calendar probably isn't necessarily a sign that they've done anything wrong. It just, last year was a little bit unbalanced.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the wild card in that scenario is the Scarlet Cars. It really depends what happens with the Ferrari this year. I mean, there's been some talk about the different areas that they're going to try and develop in the engine, which maybe might not point to exactly where they were doing naughty things in 2018 and 2019, but may kind of, you know, point in a direction where they're trying to find power in legitimate ways, you know, allegedly. So that I think that is the big unknown. I mean, if they can pick it up and find some more performance, if they can kind of get back closer to where they were in the past several years, rather than the first two thirds of this 2020 season Ferrari, then yeah, I could certainly see that middle of the pack, the best of the rest battle, kind of being shaken up with your Aston Martins, your Ferraris, your AlphaTauris. You can even throw them in there, and McLaren as well. So it you know, that middle of the pack battle, I think, could be a fascinating one to watch this year.
Yeah, and I think, well, middle of the pack, I even think that the top, because it's probably evident that Mercedes is going to have a very, very strong year. It's probably going to be a very strong year for Red Bull, but I think potentially Aston Martin could be more competitive than we think. And I don't know that they're necessarily going to be competing with the middle of the pack. And maybe they're a little bit more competitive with the Red Bulls of the world. And I hate to speak in such vagaries, but I just think that's a reality. And I know you hate when I do this, but I just wanted to bring this up real quick and take us off tangent. But I saw something on Reddit today, which I thought was fantastic. And the Reddit users are really great with data, but they brought up a chart, and I'm only going to read a couple of them to you, but just in the kind of the conversation of McLaren and Ferrari and all these other kind of teams, F1 wins by car color. You can probably guess, which car color do you think has won the most races in Formula One in the sport's history?
I would say red.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Red cars have won 271, or wow, 27% of all of the races. Now, wow, this one shocked me, and I would be very surprised. Actually, you know what? I wouldn't be too surprised if you got this one. The second color. Which is the second most dominant car color in terms of race wins?
I would go silver.
Close. It's actually blue.
Really?
234 wins, or 23% of race wins, followed up by silver. Thank you, McLaren or Mercedes, for their dominance at 18%, and then white at 17%.
Wow.
Orange is just 6 wins at 0.6%. But yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting that blue cars have won the second most races. And presumably they're speaking to the Williams Renault cars of the early 90s that were very dominant. But yeah, just to take us off track, and I'll get scolded for that later, but now we can come back on track.
Well, no, actually, that's a good one to kind of like, you know, an interesting tangent to go off on, because we were talking about it the other day, just that perhaps, you know, there's this rumor now, this story that perhaps Renault is going to partner up again with Williams to provide them with power units moving forward. And, you know, you texted me there the other day. It's like, what do you think of that? And I think my answer was, oh, yes, please, because, you know, that goes back to the Williams-Renault glory days of the 90s. And of course, the glory days of the 80s were Williams-Honda, and that's obviously not going to be a thing. So, you know, they won a lot of races. They won a lot of championships with Renault power. And I think that's interesting because, you know, if you believe the talk out there, you know, they were, you know, they're really interested in pursuing like a partnership with Sauber. And I guess, you know, what with that, you know, upping that sponsorship slash whatever you want to call it with Alfa Romeo completely, you know, blew that one out of the water. So it would be interesting. It would be a natural fit. But I find it kind of interesting because, you know, before Cyril Abiteboul left the team, he basically said that there was no real benefit for them to supply, you know, another team with power units. You know, it wasn't really a money-making thing for them. So it's an interesting development that the new regime there is thinking of that. So it's certainly one to keep an eye on for sure.
I was so excited when I saw that headline, and you and I have talked about this so much that it always seemed very peculiar that Renault wasn't looking for a customer team for their power units, right? Like if you have a partner team, it dramatically helps to subsidize the cost of producing that power unit. And the side benefit or the knock-on benefit of having a partner team is that you get all the incremental data that comes with running that engine in two additional cars. So it benefits your own team. And it never made sense. And the reason that it really excites me is that if Renault is looking potentially for a customer team, it speaks to the fact that they're probably more invested in the long-term association with the sport than we think. Like my fear always was that, hey, if they're not looking for a customer team tie-up, maybe they're not in this for the long-term. So I think the fact that they're looking for a customer team is exciting because it speaks to the fact that organizationally, they're really invested in Formula One. They wouldn't be looking for a customer team because kind of partnering with a team and integrating the power unit and integrating the resources and that all the data and the interfaces, like it costs tens of millions of dollars just to build that relationship before you even start handing over a power unit.
Yeah.
So this is exciting. And to your earlier point too, and it was so funny because I text you and you texted back with a photo of a 1/18 scale Williams Reno, and I'm a super nerd. So I went up to my shelf and I texted back with a photo of one of my models, but you're right. You look at the early 90s, like they won the Constructors Championship in 92 and 93 and 94 and 96 and 97. They were second in 95. They had an absolutely monster run. And for the sake of romance aside, I would love to see that relationship rekindled. But at the same time, I'd be worried that if Williams can't be competitive with the best power unit in the sport, in that Mercedes unit, I don't know what it's going to look like if they have to start over with a Renault power unit. But it's good that Renault is looking at a partner team for all the reasons I just described.
Yeah, you know, just I'm having like a major sentimental flashbacks here of those early 90s Williams car. I mean, you have like Nigel Mansell's, what was the FW15B in 1992? Yep. That was basically a car, it couldn't drive itself, but it had some groundbreaking technology on there, especially like that active suspension. That is just absolutely phenomenal. I mean, just a beautiful car to look at. I believe the car that I snapped a picture of, I believe that was the FW18, which would have been Damon Hill's championship winning car. And then, they were just racking up the titles in the 90s. I mean, it seems like a long, long time ago. And then after that, I also remember them vividly in the early 2000s, that BMW partnership and the HP partnership. And, somewhere in here, I've got the Ralf Schumacher hat that I picked up at the Nürburgring all those years ago, maybe we should go away or move on to the next one before the feels get too intense here. I go too far down memory lane.
I know, and I'm tempted, like, that I've got so much sentimentality about this because, you know, especially that 92 season with Nigel Mansell. Like I was back in the UK, and I would remember every weekend because my grandparents were huge Formula One fans. Mm. They were huge Williams fans, and they were huge Nigel Mansell fans. Like, yeah. I remember every Sunday sitting in their kitchen, watching on their little white Sony Trinitron TV, watching the Formula One race every single Sunday. And of course, at that period, it was like a Nigel Mansell kind of domination thon. Like, he was winning every single week. So, like, this is really deeply ingrained in my memory for all those sentimental reasons. But yeah, that's just another reason why I'm very, very sentimental towards that period of F1. But you're right, we should definitely move on.
You know, just to stay on the Nigel Mansell thing here, I remember as a young kid watching, was it when he was driving for Lotus? Now, I'm talking, I was like really, really little. And I think it was Dallas, and I don't remember the year, but it was early to mid 80s. I remember him running out of gas, like running out of petrol, getting out of the car, pushing the car to get across the finish line, and then collapsing afterwards because he was exhausted because of the heat, because of the exertion of driving a Grand Prix car, over the last 2 hours or something. Then I also remember as a young kid, the 1985 European Grand Prix at Brands Hatch, which I think might have been his first win in Formula One. And I remember watching that as a young kid with my dad. And I remember Williams giving him an absolutely phenomenal, like super quick, well, in 1985 terms, of pit stops. And he went on, I believe he won that race. And, you know, it sticks in my memory. I don't have the stats here. And then, of course, anybody that was a Formula One fan back in the day will remember Nigel having that massive blowout of his rear tire on that back straight in Adelaide in 1986, which cost him the championship. And, but by that time, as a kid, I was absolutely hooked on Formula One, and it's something that's never let up since.
That Dallas race, by the way, and I encourage you as our listeners to go and look this up. It was the 1984 race. 84, look it up on YouTube. Yep. It was the final lap. His transmission failed.
Okay.
It was 40 degrees Celsius.
I knew it was bloody hot. 40
degrees Celsius. Yeah. Ridiculous. Like, so 105 degrees Fahrenheit. It's 40 degrees air temperature. Like, you're walking around the track and, again, crazy, crazy, crazy. But look it up on YouTube.
I mean, back in the day too, I mean, instead when they had those really thick fireproof overalls, I mean, it's not like the super sleek ones that the guys wear today. I mean, completely different. But anyways, enough for memory lane. Let's get back on track.
That needs to be a segment, by the way. We need to have a memory lane segment.
MotoGP corner, memory lane. You know, we could probably have a 4-hour show each and every week. But just talking about the schedule. So it sounds like now that the chances of going back to Portimao for this year is not going to happen. Sadly, you know, this is very disappointing, but, you know, it wasn't really officially on the chat or like on the schedule to begin with. I mean, we've been hoping it would be, but sounds like it's going to be off. Sounds like we're going to have like another Bahrain too, by the sounds of it, but I guess it'll make make sense that way. I mean, China, Vietnam, we knew they were off the schedule already. You've hinted at Montreal is probably going to be the next one that's going to fall off here. So we'll see, but certainly that that would have been a good add to the season. So disappointed that one probably isn't going to happen.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's clear, and again, it was so funny because when I saw this headline come across on Twitter or wherever it was, I was really disappointed, and then I realized it was never officially on the calendar. I just keep talking about it as like if it was that in my mind, it became fact, like it's on the calendar. It was never on the calendar. So you're right, like it makes total sense for a second race in Bahrain. You know what, you're already going to go down there for winter testing. You basically put the entire sport in a bubble for 4 weeks, let them do winter testing, let them run the inner ring, let them run the outer ring, and then you can move off to continental Europe. It wasn't clear to me though, was the thought that you would potentially move Imola back by a couple of weeks and you would stage the second Bahrain race where the Imola race was supposed to be? Or was it that we were potentially going to get a race a week or two earlier than maybe we were expecting the season to begin? I can't confirm, but I think that's kind of an interesting conversation point as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this Rubik's Cube of the season and the schedule and what's on and what's off and what might be rescheduled or canceled at this point has become a little bit confusing. I haven't been able to keep up quite
me
honestly.
Me too.
I'm just disappointed that that Port Mal isn't probably going to happen because, you know, it may not have been on the schedule on paper, but it was on the schedule in our hearts. So I guess we'll just have to be hopeful it'll come back another year. Anyways, Mark, let's just take a quick break here on the Overtime Media Network. When we come back in a minute, we're going to talk about, silly gimmicks, something like that. And we'll do so in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And Mark, it sounds like the reverse grid idea is finally out. It's not going to happen. They're thinking about sprint races and some other things. And I'm glad that the reverse grid thing is not going to happen. You know, it's apparently been shelved completely, you know, according to CEO Stefano Domenicali. And I think this is a great thing. That for me was too gimmicky. It was too much in the same spirit of this rolling cutoff time we saw a couple of years ago. I'm very much up for the idea of the sprint races. But certainly, you know, to pass like a final judgment, I'd have to see like a total proposal. I have to admit, I'm a bit of a traditionalist. I like the format that that it is now. And I would have to say that anything that they have to introduce, I think would have to be like a big value add to the sport. I just don't want to change it just for the sake of changing it. And I certainly don't want to change things too soon until we see the benefits of the cost cap, the benefits of the new regulations or lack thereof. So I don't think in my books that this is something that needs to be done too quickly because they're considering trials of sprint races in 2021. I think that's fair enough, but I don't think they need to push it through too fast.
Yeah, I agree. And it's funny because when I saw this headline, the first thing I actually went to do was I went to Reddit because I wanted to get a sense of kind of what the fans are thinking. And overwhelmingly, the sentiment on Reddit and on some of the forums I was checking was very much the same. Like one, the fans aren't asking for this. The drivers aren't asking for this. The teams aren't asking for this. Mm-hmm. You don't throw these kind of gimmicky innovations on us when nobody's asking for it. And you know, I'm super relieved that we're going to walk away from that reverse grid because that to me was infuriating. Like you're doing so much to create parity within the sport. Like the transformation that we're going to see over the next couple of years in terms of the cost cap and the unified architecture in terms of design and engineering. Like this is the most transformative the sport's ever been in terms of creating, I would say, foundational parity within the sport. And if you can't achieve that with a cost cap and you can't achieve that with new formula regulations, you're never going to be able to do that with a reverse grid. So I'm so thrilled that garbage, gimmicky reverse grid is out of the window. I think to your point too, like I just don't know what value a sprint race would necessarily add. Maybe like I'm open to the idea of, you know what, throw out some points for qualifying, you know, make qualifying a little bit more, like create some more value in qualifying. But I don't like this concept of like, hey, let's throw out a sprint race when nobody's asking for it. And it could just muddy and sully the sport as a whole. Because again, from a Liberty perspective, you're trying so hard to, one, open up new markets, and two, keep your existing fan base content. And when you do gimmicky things like this, you upset your existing fan base, but you also create a more confusing product for potentially new viewers, right? I've completely aligned with you on this one.
You know, it'd be interesting. I mean, how about they give points out for maybe the fastest three times in Q1, 2, and 3 or something like that, rather than say, you know, give points out for the final 10 cars in the top 10 shootout. I mean, something totally. Like that. You know, like I would hate to rush something in, like you say, before we see the benefit of all these things that they work so hard to introduce.
Yes.
And you know, for that exact purpose of leveling the playing field, getting that parity across the board, it seems a little bit too much cart in front of the, or horse in front of the cart, or cart in front of the horse, whatever that old saying. Well, I guess the horse goes in front of the cart. Anyways, you know what I'm getting at here. I think they have to give a chance to the, you know, all the measures that they put in place, and they work so hard in the middle of a global pandemic, you know, lockdown, to get this stuff done in record time. I think they have to give that a chance first.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to see them distract from all the good work they've done. And the good work is, you know what, getting all of the teams on board with the new regulations and getting all the teams on board with a new formula for a cost cap and getting all the teams on board with a new Concord agreement. Like, Liberty's done so many great things to put this sport in a really great sustainable position for the next 5 or 10 years. Don't destroy that by creating a distraction with a garbage reverse grid race or a sprint race or some of these other gimmicky things. To your point, and you make a great point, like, you've done all these great foundational things. Let some of these things play out before you start modifying with the formula over the course of a race weekend. Like, I think they've done some great things. And you know what? Again, from my perspective, I don't actually love the idea of a cost cap, but I know it's the right thing for the sport. It's the right thing for it to be sustainable, because me being a romantic, like, I want to see the best teams spend all the money in the world and put the best possible car on the track. But I also know that that's terrible for the long-term viability of the sport. So I think they're doing the right things. They were remarkably able to get all of the teams and all of the engine manufacturers onto the same page. Let this play out over the course of the next couple of years. Don't go tinkering with the formula right now, because you're just going to upset everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't really have anything to add to that. So we'll wait and see what happens. Like I say, I hope they just don't rush it through. But one thing they absolutely need to do, and this is something that both Chase Carey and Stefano Domenicali have been talking about, is raising the profile of Formula One in the United States in 2021. And this is something that absolutely has to happen. It is basically an untapped market in terms of the sport. And, you know, the United States is a huge market for sports, huge market for automobiles. This just makes so much sense. They keep talking about the adding another race alongside the U.S. Grand Prix at Austin. Obviously, they're pretty far along in the discussions to hold one in Miami. And they're talking about either having two permanent races in the United States, or perhaps one permanent one, and then maybe a rotation of other venues. Apparently, there's other cities, other venues throughout the country that they've been talking to. They're nowhere as far along in terms of discussion that they are with the, you know, potential Miami race. So I think this is well and long overdue.
I absolutely agree. One of the things that I think a lot of our listeners may not know about me is I actually enjoy the business side of Formula One and sports more than I actually do what happens on the court or within what happens on the track. And I get really invested in these kind of discussions. And I think it's really important for our listeners to understand that Liberty never would have invested in Formula One if it didn't believe there was some really significant financial upside. The reality is that if you look at the sport and where it's extracting revenues today, principally that's coming from Western Europe with hosting fees and TV contracts from Sky Sports, etc. It's happening in the Middle East with some really, really weighty hosting fees. But as far as the current calendar is concerned, there isn't a lot of additional value to extract. And ultimately, remember, Liberty's a publicly traded company. They need to show value to their shareholders. And they would never have spent billions of dollars on this product if they didn't have a plan. And their plan is the United States. Exactly like you said, as far as they're concerned, the United States is a completely untapped market in terms of revenue possibilities. So little of what they generate from an OI perspective comes from the United States. It's ridiculous. But the challenge is, It's really difficult to get Americans invested in a sport which is perceived as being principally European or foreign. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful or potentially kind of racist manner, but for them, this is something that happens overseas. And the only way that you can increase the presence and the popularity of the sport in the United States is by having additional races. And you got to remember as well, the United States is geographically a gigantic country. A race in Austin, Texas has absolutely no impact on what happens in South Florida or what happens in the Northeast or really even what happens in California. Yep. So as far as Liberty is concerned, and I've talked to a lot of people around the sport, Liberty's goal is 3 full-time races in the United States. They need to have 3 races because that's the only way that they believe they can tap into the TV money that's potentially there, right? Like if they're looking at ESPN and saying, hey, you know what? We want to shore up a long-term big dollar TV contract with you. ESPN's going to say, look, you're giving us one domestic race and you're giving us mediocre or poor ratings. And even if they're creasing 100% year over year, they're so low that's insignificant. The only way you can build that audience is by expansion, and that's going to be 3 races. So I think Miami's probably going to happen. They're going to push that through despite all of the local opposition, which is a little bit terrible. But I think potentially you're going to eventually see a race in the Northeast as well. I think California is going to be a challenge, and I know a lot of people point at Long Beach and like, hey, that would be a great place. As far as bureaucracy and red tape concerned, it's not going to happen there. But I think Liberty's goal is we need to increase the value of the sport. We need to increase our OI. And they see the U.S. as the pathway to doing that.
You know, I'll totally believe that the Formula One is a thing in the United States. The day that I walk into 7-Eleven and a cardboard cutout of Lewis Hamilton is suggesting I get a 6-pack of Bud Light or I buy a Coke, then I'll know that the Formula One has made it in North America.
And I was just going to say, and the only other thing too is one way or the other, they got to get an American driver into the sport.
Yep.
Even if you have 3 American races, you can't sell a host of European drivers to an American audience, right? And I think we all remember Ricky Bobby, where there was that French driver that was kind of his arch nemesis. But ultimately, you also need to be able to nurture some American drivers and get them into Formula One. And that should be feasible ultimately because you have such a great history of open wheel racing in that country. But obviously, as far as Liberty's concerned, more American races is their pathway, whether they're talking about it openly or not.
Well, there you go. You heard it on this show first. In order for Formula One to succeed in the United States, needs a little bit more shake and bake. There you go. I had to make it. You dropped the Ricky Bobby reference. I couldn't let that one slide. Anyways, just as we start to wrap up the show, there was a couple of interesting stories and kind of rumors out there. And this is one we talked about a little bit. Apparently that Ferrari is already interested in giving Carlos Sainz an extension. And I think this is one that that we've talked about a little bit over the past month or so. He's on a 1-year deal. He has a 2-year deal, but he hasn't, he's only had one test session. I mean, he's not even, hasn't even raced yet. He got Mick Schumacher waiting in the wings at Haas. I think it seems a little bit soon to be talking about that. I mean, it's obviously a very, very young lineup that they have there. I mean, bringing Mick Schumacher would probably drive that average age down even more. But it seems very premature that Mattia Binotto would be suggesting that so early before we've even got a race or 2 or 6 or 10 under our belt, and we can say, okay, well, now we've got an idea of how Carlos lines up against Charles Leclerc, and is this going to work?
I think the first thing that comes to my mind is that's awfully optimistic, because I don't know that Binotto is going to be with Ferrari in 2 years to see Sainz taking a third season.
Great
right
point.
Like this is a guy that has, again, he's nice and he's charismatic and he's accessible to the media and he says all the right things, but he also oversaw the horror show, which was the FIA scandal. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, and he needs to be accountable for that. And he needs to be accountable for the fact that the relationship with Vettel and Leclerc played out so poorly on a public stage. But I think it's absolutely absurd for him to be making these comments. Like I can't reconcile myself with what he has seen that he would put those comments out there so early. You know, if Sainz was in a 1-year deal and he was looking good, and he was doing great in the simulator, and his relationship with Leclerc was strong. You know, okay, that makes sense. You know, you start teasing that second season. You know, if it's a great year, and we see these things, and you know what, I can see a second year. But he's got a two-year deal. Like, to be suggesting that you're going to re-up a third year is absurd. He's never, to your point, he's never driven a race. He's never been in practice. He's never qualified. We have no idea what his capabilities are. And to be totally honest, it's, you could argue that the car he's going to be driving in next year is fundamentally inferior to the car that he was in last year. So there's no guarantee that he's even going to score more points in this upcoming season than he did the last season. So, and again, you and I've talked about this a lot as well. My sense is that Ferrari ultimately is obviously hungry to get Mick Schumacher into that car. And he's absolutely not going to replace Charles Leclerc because he's the organizational golden boy at this point. But yeah, I was really shocked by those comments.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting too, because if you see some of the comments that Günther Steiner, team principal of Haas, has been saying, that he's not really expecting, or does he'll be happy if Mick doesn't break through the walls this year, something to that expect, or to that effect. But you know, I find that a little bit interesting. That I think that's fine for Günther to say that, but the overachievers, that is the family Schumacher, especially when it comes to motor racing, I think that Mick will be doing everything that he can. It might take him a little while to find his feet in Formula One. Yeah. Obviously, I mean, a Formula One car is very different than what he's used to. I mean, there is going to be a learning there curve there, obviously. But I mean, we look at how quickly Charles Leclerc took to Formula One. I mean, he was a rock star in that first year at Sauber. And I mean, just the difference between him and his then teammate, Marcus Ericsson. I mean, he was so much quicker in the same garbage car that was a C37 or whatever it was. I mean, it was not a great car, but he was that much better than his teammates. So who knows? I mean, will Mick Schumacher have the same lightning start to Formula One? Will it be a slow start? Will it be somewhere in the middle? I don't know, of course. I mean, this story is still to be written, but I think that, like you say, I think these are very peculiar comments that Binotto is making at this point, considering the only Ferrari that Sainz has driven so far is like a 2018 car. I mean, obviously nobody's driven the new cars yet. They haven't had a race, so that seems premature to make such a statement. And finally, we're going to stay on this Ferrari tangent. We already hinted at it with the quotes there from not Gene Haas, but from Günther Steiner. But Romain Grosjean is apparently very, well, obviously everybody remembers Romain, who was obviously a Haas driver, but apparently he's very keen to take up Toto Wolff on an offer for a test at Mercedes. And there's a bit of a backstory to that, but Grosjean, obviously out of Formula One, going to IndyCar next year. His final moment in a Formula One car was that awful crash at Sakhir that you just still can't believe that he walked away from that one. And look, let's be honest. I have not been the biggest fan about Romain Grosjean as a racing driver, but I was scared to death at what I saw. And I was absolutely, like everybody else, I was ecstatic to see him get out of the car with relatively minor injuries. But, you know, it's just kind of sad that potentially could be his last moment in Formula One. And Haas is apparently not able to give him a test because they don't have any power units in the old cars or anything like that. So Toto Wolff, and I think this is great, he said that if there's nobody else out there in the teams that Roman has raced for, Mercedes would step up and give him the opportunity to do a private test for them. So to basically finish his Formula One career on a high note. And if that goes ahead, I think that's a great move on the behalf of Toto Wolff and Mercedes.
Yeah, it's a sweet gesture. And I think it's important to note as well, and I can't remember if we talked about this before, but it looks like Grosjean's going to IndyCar circuit next season.
Yep.
So he's got a ride, so he'll be back in a competitive open-wheel racing car next season. The one thing that I thought was interesting, and we should probably call out as well, is while he's agreed to a contract to race in Indy next year, he will not be racing at any of the super oval speedways. And his comment was simply that, I can't put my children and my family through that. Meaning that the super speedways are, as far as open wheel racing are concerned, very, very, very dangerous. But just to comment on the Mercedes piece, ultimately, it costs Toto and Mercedes nothing to put him in the car for a test. It creates huge goodwill amongst the fans and the spectators. Yep. Like, it's a great story. I think it's the right thing to do. It kind of speaks to that narrative about Ferrari or Mercedes' dominance, right? That you have a team that is so incredibly dominant that a sweet gesture is to give somebody a 60-minute session in your car. You know what? But I think it's a great story. I'm excited to see Grosjean in his limited races next year in Indy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mark, that's it. That's all I've got. I'm completely talked out. I mean, well, I'm not. I mean, we could probably easily go on for another hour or so, but I think we'll spare everyone the ordeal of that. And well, you know, we are now one day closer to the start of the Formula One season. We're obviously excited, and we're going to have to start working some of these other things that we've been teasing about, like Memory Lane, the MotoGP corner. These have to become a thing sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I agree. I have a rant about Electronic Arts, the video game company, but save that for next week, because I know this has been a long podcast and I kind of want to tease for next week. But if you enjoy my rants, and you probably don't, but I have one about Electronic Arts for next week. So I'm going to save that up and just tease it.
I'll have to tell my buddies that work for EA not to listen to the show next week, but it's all good.
I think all of us in Vancouver know somebody or many people that work at Electronic Arts. They have a pretty significant presence in our home city.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a fact of life around here. Totally. All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for downloading and listening to the show, watching on YouTube. Of course, if you want to get in touch, easiest way is on Twitter at ScuderiaF1Pod or via email at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. That's a wrap. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. Stay in touch. And we'll talk to you guys again this time next week. Bye for now.